You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC, so if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
Just put the money on the floor, kick it over me. No cops! I said no cops!
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from D's World Studios in San Antonio, Texas, this is The Social Hour. On today's show, attorney and bail reform expert Ken Good. And now your host. With Trump back in office, he's thinking about changing his last name back to its original spelling, Casillas Berg. Dees Casillas.
Malam Keen, everyone. Welcome to the show. This is The Social Hour. I am Dees. Thank you for coming back for another episode. We appreciate you hanging out. As always, guys, tell a friend if you enjoy the show. Let someone know. Rate us on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen to the show. I know we've had been off a couple weeks. I was traveling, but I am back. I've got a couple weeks worth of shows lined up for you now to get back on that monthly schedule. We did pretty good in 2024. Getting back on the weekly schedule, I should say, not monthly. So we're getting back into it, and I'm looking at a new dedicated studio space now that I'm kind of getting, finally, after 2 years, getting settled in Texas, so we can get the full studio and a crew back onto the show and get this bad boy going full time again. So as for me, guys, go to deescomedy.com, check out everything going on across the network, live shows. I will be at Artisan Distillery this Friday doing some comedy. I will also be at Upstage Comedy Lounge on December 8th. I will be in North Carolina starting, I think that's December 13th, for about a week, so doing shows. So check out the calendar on the website. I'll be around. I'm not doing a ton through the end of the year, but I will be doing some shows around, mostly Texas, and then starting the first of the year, hitting the road hard again. You can find me in Arizona, Kansas, Montana, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, California. I'm going to be everywhere. So get the tickets, get the dates, and come check it out. And that is it for commercials, guys. We're going to get into it with our guest today. He comes all the way, not that far actually, from Tyler, Texas today. He is a attorney. Please welcome Kevin Good, everyone, or Ken Good. Sorry, Ken. Ken. I was talking to my buddy Kevin right before we got on this. Ken Good, everyone. How you doing, Ken?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. But you know, the funny thing is you called me Kevin, and so I had a case one time that was on Court TV, and all the discovery, the guy had called me Kevin for 2 years, and I waited until right before jury selection to say, by the way, my name's not Kevin, it's Ken.
Get those extra points in right when you can. On Court TV, was this like a high-profile case then, or...?
It was a medical malpractice case, so, you know, okay. All the I started out as an attorney representing doctors and hospitals when they got sued. So that's where I got my training and then my appellate work. And so I was kind of always known as the law guy. And so that case, we had a trial team that was undefeated.
Wow.
The Court TV, all the commentators were saying we were going to lose big. And probably the jury was out maybe less than an hour. And it was a terrible case. But they agreed with us on our theory on what happened. And they agreed with the doctor that he didn't do anything wrong.
I'm always intrigued by medical malpractice because it seems like such a, it's like a really interesting topic because, first of all, I hear a lot of doctors I know say how much less people are going into medicine because the cost of being a doctor and being insured is almost prohibitive compared to making money as a doctor anymore.
Well, I think there's a whole bunch of defensive medicine in Texas, but you know, Texas, the legislature passed tort reform, which was geared towards medical malpractice probably 10, 15, maybe 20 years ago.
Okay.
And so that has a positive impact, and so you don't just have in my opinion, trolls out there. Anytime there's something that looks bad, you're going to get sued. So So I think that those reforms were good, and I got trained by probably one of the best defense attorneys in what I would consider in the state of Texas, if not the country. You know, at that time, you know, defense attorneys were considered, oh, we're going to be the really polite people. We're going to be, you know, we're going to turn the other cheek when the plaintiff's attorneys are just get down in the mud. The guy that trained me to practice law said, you want to get down in the mud? We'll get down in the mud and we'll have fun and we'll do to you everything you do to us. And yeah. So that's the way I was kind of trained to be a medical malpractice lawyer. And I really have always enjoyed appellate work. So, you know, at the end, I went to a Med-Mal seminar, or we all did, and they had a section on new and important cases from the appellate courts. Three of the five were my cases. So it's always been, I've been lucky in everything I've done. I've just, it turns into important issues.
Yeah, I got to imagine as a defense attorney dealing with your, you know, ambulance chaser lawyers, that's got to be a nightmare.
Well, I mean, you know, just like any other area, there's people that specialize in that. And so there's the people that when you know that they're the plaintiff's attorneys, that's going to cost your client another $50,000 because they're going to make you, I mean, they're going to make you work for everything.
Yeah.
And so you get to where you don't like certain plaintiff's attorneys. But I mean, that was a long time ago now. But yeah, I mean, it was incredible experience, a lot of good training. And really the person who trained me is no longer practicing law. But it was interesting, because, you know, once I started developing my own practice, he still wouldn't let go of me. He wanted me to go to court with him all the time, even though he already had another attorney who was doing his discovery. And I'm like, I finally had to sit down with him and say, look, I've got my own practice now. You've got somebody you're training. He was not me, but he's going to do as good a job as me. So you've got to take him to court. And so... He finally agreed.
Finally gave you some breathing space. Yeah. Yeah. It's like when I moved to Texas, I started to see, you probably see him everywhere too. Those billboards with the guy with his four, you know, the four and all those lawyers who people get hit by trucks, by semi-trucks.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a big thing in Texas. And I'm like, my God, how many people are getting smashed by semi-trucks in Texas? And they're like, I got my client $10 billion.
Well, you know, the reason why you have those billboards is because they have to carry at least a minimum of $1 million of insurance.
The truckers.
And so that's a big thing for you to, you know, shoot at.
Yeah.
But, you know, then at the same time, my father-in-law, you know, I mean, my father-in-law went on vacation and he was in a car accident where a truck changed lanes and while he's in the other lane and, you know, end up, he died as a result of it. But, you know, I did medical malpractice until, you know, a bondsman got in trouble, had, you know, a bunch of default judgments, which means he forgot to file an answer. And so he asked somebody, what kind of attorney do you hire for this? They said, well, you need an appellate attorney. And I know a good one. So I fixed that for him, started doing word of mouth, representing other bondsmen, finally became Texas counsel for several insurance companies. I go, you know, I'm on the board of directors of the state association. We go to the legislature and argue for and against bills. And so, and then with all the bail reform, I set about to become knowledgeable with my appellate experience, and I've written a bunch of articles on those subjects now.
Yeah, this was so when your representative reached out to me, this was really interesting to me because as someone from California, specifically South Central LA, with, you know, a history of crime and issues there, and then watching that state's, especially LA and, you know, San Francisco and the bigger cities just crumble and the way they've changed, you know, they change, create, you know, reduce the amount of felonies being committed every year by just reducing them all to misdemeanors.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, on paper, it looks great. You know, no more felonies. Well, yeah, you're just not charging anyone. And they don't have the bandwidth to charge. They just basically throw out misdemeanors some of the time. There's no cash bail in California, in LA anymore. So you're like, you're talking about a system, and there's no, it's not even considered theft. It's under $950. So you're
but it started out with Proposition 47, where they were changing felonies to misdemeanors.
Right.
But they said their argument is, oh, they'll still have to answer for their charges, but they'll still be able to get jobs. And then when it passed, then our urban area DAs like Gascon, who just got defeated by 20 something points, said, well, we're no longer going to prosecute theft under $950.
Right.
And so as you pointed out, the impact of that has been crime going running amok, and the impact it's had on our commercial properties has just been catastrophic.
Well, not only commercial properties, but you see it in, again, I lived, from LA. I lived in Washington for a while, spent a lot of time in Seattle and Portland doing comedy when I lived in the Northwest. And I watched those cities just completely go to wastelands. And then you have all the businesses in those areas just flee. And then you're talking about a problem with employment when there's no businesses, and you're like, it's like a trickle down thing of it's just steamrolls,
Yes. And that's exactly what happens, because first you have all the shoplifting, like, and business can't withstand $25,000 a day of shoplifting.
Yeah.
So they start closing. When they start closing, there's no business that'll take the place. So as a result, the commercial properties values crash. Mm-hmm. I mean, in San Francisco, you see a property sell for 30 to 50% of what they sold for 3 or 4 years ago. In Minneapolis, same problem. You see two commercial properties sold in the last 60 days for 9% of what they sold for the last time they sold. So, I mean, the problem is that is going to have a huge impact on our tax bases. And so you've started to see our mayors in our urban areas start to cry uncle because they can't withstand losing all these tax revenues.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. You know, it's like in – listen, when I lived in Washington State, I worked with a homeless outreach program, and I have a lot of empathy for homeless people. But there's this, there's also, we can't let them run rampant at the expense of the people who live and function in the city. You know, like, we can't just let the homeless people run around and steal and shit everywhere and destroy stuff, and the people who actually live in the city and work downtown and pay taxes can't even go use the businesses because they're afraid to go park downtown at night. It's like, then why live there? What are you even doing?
You're going to see more and more stories about these about homeless. I mean, and I agree with you. I mean, I have some sympathy for homeless people, but I also have we have to have public safety. We have to have peace.
Right.
And I've had two articles that I've seen in the last several days since Trump got elected, where for the first time they've been reporting when they go in and clean up one of these homeless encampments, they find women that have been either chained or staked to the ground, and they're being sold for sex.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, we've got human trafficking that these encampments are doing, using, and that has been covered up in for the last year or two, as they've been looking the other way in the honorable name of homelessness.
Right.
And when I first noticed this, because I'd read an article about how the legal drug trade for marijuana in California has failed or is collapsing, and it's being taken over by the cartels. Mm-hmm. Well, I just posted it and shared it to my Facebook page. It was immediately deleted before the election.
Oh,
and I'm
yeah.
like, well, that can't be true. I mean, that was just a mistake. So I posted again, immediately deleted. And so, I mean, those are the two things that I think were being intentionally edited out of the news cycles before the election. You're going to see more and more of that now that the election's over.
Yeah, I think those things are starting to come to light. And, for better or worse, however people voted, I think America showed that I don't even want to say the values, just what's important to them, and that they need the infrastructure of the country needs to change. When it talks about crime, when it talks about homelessness, when it talks about the economy, those things are important to people, and just hasn't been focused on in this last administration at all.
Well, Trump has run for the White House 3 times now. The first 2 times, the final polls were off on average 2.5 points and underestimate his support. And so right before the election, I was writing down all the polls because I was like, is this like the last 2 times Trump ran, or is this like Romney Obama, where they overestimated Romney, the Republican support, by 1.5 points, and that's the reason why Obama got reelected. And so I just felt confident that the polls were going to be wrong one way or the other. And so they turned out to be wrong on average 2.5 points. I believe, in underestimating Trump support. So Arizona, 5 or 6 points.
Yeah.
But Wisconsin, less than a point. Pennsylvania, about a point and a half, point, whatever. So I think that, the problem that I see with, you know, before the election is all this polling. I think there's so much more push polling. You know, historically, we've always seen where there's been a period where the polls are trying to get people to move towards a candidate. But usually after Labor Day, it stops because they want their reputation to be maintained.
Yeah.
I just felt like this time all the polls sold their soul to the devil, except maybe a couple.
Yeah.
But when the poll came out for, where was Idaho, saying that that Trump was suddenly tied by, I mean, was behind by 3 when he was all the polls up till that, so he was going to win by 9 or 10. I mean, you knew that they'd sold their soul.
Yeah.
Because he ended up winning by 13 or something. The poll was off by 13.
Yeah, there was no way Idaho wasn't voting for Trump.
Yeah.
As someone who spent a lot of time in Idaho, there's no way Idaho is not.
Well, but you know, if you look at what was the reason why Trump won? I think crime was an important issue.
Yeah.
I think immigration was an important issue. Like here in Texas, every border county, which has a history of voting for the Democrat candidate, voted for Trump except one.
Right.
Now, that's a direct result of the border and immigration policy and the resulting crime.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, I think we have this whole debate that we've been doing this debate for 3 years about is crime going up? And you have one party just saying flat out, crime's not going up. Don't believe your lying eyes. Look at the FBI statistics. I mean, that's all they pointed to. And everything else showed crime going up. And so it became, is the FBI statistics correct or not? And, you know, a month ago, I wrote an article that was published in the Attorney at Law magazine. And I was just pointing out all the reasons why I thought the FBI statistics could be called into question. I mean, there's other government agencies that track crime, like the CDC tracks homicides, and they differed greatly with what the FBI statistics showed. And, you know, Trump was showing what the DOJ crime survey showed, and that showed crime was up substantially. And so, I mean, we didn't even have to talk about car thefts and, you know, how those are probably the most accurate barometer of crime because they – insurance companies still require a police report before they'll pay off a carjacking claim.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the funny thing was I had that article published. 9 days later, the FBI came out and changed their statistics. And suddenly, instead of the crime going down, it showed crime going up. It's still incomplete because it's still not – it was a big move up, but it still, I don't think, is accurately reflecting the true crime rate. But, I mean, the Attorney at Law magazine put a little postscript to my article saying – hey, 9 days after this article was published, the FBI changed it. It wasn't because of the article, but I think it was probably they were worried Trump was going to get reelected, and so they wanted to make sure that their statistics were as up to date as possible. I mean, but it took away all of their arguments on crime because it was the only one they had. And so what did they do? They immediately switched to Trump is Satan, Trump is Hitler, Trump is a fascist. And that's all they did for 7 to 10 days because they could not talk about crime anymore.
Why do you think that is? What do you think as, you know, someone who's embedded in this and does this for a living and has for a long time and probably has some, you know, some insight in legalese and other things that whether of us don't. Why do you think the FBI would either intentionally or unintentionally, do you think they intentionally fudged the numbers? And if so, why do you think so? And who does that?
Okay, I think there's two explanations for what happened. So let's just talk about what happened. So 4 or 5 years ago, the FBI changed the way they gather crime statistics. They moved to a new system. And the new system required all the police offices to buy new equipment so that it would be reported to them. And it was slow. I mean, the police officers, the police groups have been slow to transition. In fact, the last time I checked, the two largest police forces in the country, LA and New York, had not transitioned. So,
yeah.
I mean, the first argument I would just say is the data was incomplete because it's transitioning to a new way to capture that data. And so as new police forces got the equipment, and you could argue innocently that a new or two or three or four new police groups got the new equipment, and then they automatically updated their data, and it was updated to the FBI. And so they just reflected the new additional information when it was discovered. The problem with it is that the timing makes it suspect. It's a month before the election, and it's the only thing that the Democrats have been pointing to for 3 years to support their argument that crime is not increasing. I mean, 2 years ago, this was one of the two biggest issues in the midterm elections. Crime, is it going up? We had one party say no, look at the FBI statistics. And then the other thing they argued was abortion. And so I would argue crime would have been the deciding issue 2 years ago, but for the abortion issue being so fresh.
Right.
And so and all the concerns about it so raw. And so here we are 2 years later, but you add the immigration issue to crime and then groceries, inflation, and suddenly the cost of all that. Abortion couldn't overcome the issue. And I promise you, I mean, a month before the election, I was telling all my friends, you get ready. This will be the month of abortion. All you're going to hear from them is the abortion, because they're counting on that to overcome all the other issues. And they did. They did that, but it just didn't overcome them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really all they had left. I mean, when a party is their only, their only talking point is wanting to have the right to kill their own kids. Mm. It's like, man, maybe there's other important things that America cares about, you know. And I think, it shows when, people talk to their feet in this one. People talked with their feet and they talked with their vote.
I think Trump made huge inroads in urban cities. So more people from urban cities voted for the Republican candidate than had ever voted for, I think, a Republican candidate. Now, why is that? Well, that's crime.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a result of crime.
Right.
And think about Trump. I mean, I would argue that there is no other Republican candidate that is in existence today that could have done this other than Donald Trump. Because he has the money. He has the support system from his family. And he just said, no, this isn't right, and I'm not going to agree to it. And, I mean, I just don't think there's any other person in the world that could withstand this kind of attack. So he won decisively. But imagine if we just take away this lawfare, and, I mean, it's my opinion, that's exactly what it was. You take away that, I mean, his win would have been humongous. I mean, there's a story out after the election that said that at the time Biden withdrew from the race, his own internal polling was showing that Trump was on track to win 400 electoral votes.
Wow.
So the switch saved 88 electoral votes.
It's still a landslide.
Mike. I mean, it's still a landslide, but what could it have been even with all the lawfare? So if you take the lawfare out, it would have been a huge Reagan-esque type of landslide.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, really, despite not having a primary or anything, I don't think the Democrats had anywhere they could have gone, though. You know, it didn't. Mm-hmm. Kamala was a horrible choice. You know, you're talking.
But she was also the only choice, because if they did not choose her, they would have split the party. You would have over, because they picked a black woman. He promised that he would pick a black woman, so he picked her. And so they had spent a year. If you follow these stories, you would have seen articles where they were trying to replace her for the last year and a half, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
And so when this happened, their choice was it was going to be her or they were going to split the party.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was they didn't have a lot of other options. But it's funny when you're talking about someone who had the lowest approval rating of any vice president in the history of the position. And then you've got someone who, when they ran for office in 2020, literally was pulling at less than 1% and didn't even make it to the first primary. And then this is their, you know, it's like talking about running a slow horse.
You look at they got $1 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, they got $1 billion. Look how they spent it. I mean, every celebrity that ever went somewhere for her was paid to be there. I mean, somebody confronted Oprah about it and she said, I wouldn't pay a dime. And so they pulled out the campaign reports that reports contributions and showed that two $500,000 checks were written to Oprah's production company for $1 million.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. And then you compare that. I mean, Trump had less than half the money, but his creativity, again, I don't think any other Republican could do that. His stunt at McDonald's.
Yeah.
I mean, that was priceless in value to him, and also the garbage truck. But I mean, my favorite meme after the election is him and McDonald's and his little apron with the little fry rack saying he was a former fry cook at McDonald's, and now he's president-elect of the United States of America. I mean, that was worth its weight in gold. I mean, the left couldn't give that up for 3 days. And I mean, I was just sitting there going, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching. Those two stunts made up for the millions and millions and millions of dollars that he was short.
Yeah.
And they were masterstrokes.
Well, that coupled with him willing to embrace new media. Mm-hmm. And go on the podcast like the Rogan and Theo Von and he did the Flagrant and these other podcasts he did with these comedians. I mean, you're talking about, Rogan alone was, it's like 100 million views. You know, you want to talk about getting to, the biggest podcast for black listeners, the biggest percentage of black listeners of any podcast in the world is on Joe Rogan. So you're getting such a base of that too. Whereas Kamala Harris wanted to speak to those people, didn't take that opportunity. You know, she could have talked to had the largest percentage of black listeners of any podcast in the world.
You know what? I think she's getting a hard rap on that. And the reason why is I don't think she could have talked to Joe Rogan. It's not that she was incapable of addressing the issues. It's just that her coalition was such that no matter what she said on pretty much the top 3, 4, 5 issues, whatever she said would have pissed off a half of her listeners. I mean, she can go out and say crime is rising and the FBI update shows it. So we have to change our course on what we're doing on crime. I mean, that would have lost her half her support.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, I don't think she could have handled a 3-hour conversation anyway. She would have frisked out. That's you can, you know.
I mean, she's an attorney. She's a former attorney. She's a politician. She could have talked for 3 hours. She just couldn't have. The thing she said would have hurt her with her supporters.
Yeah. So crime is rising. We've, across the country, we've got, this bail reform thing happening where places like California are doing, no cash bail and stuff like that. Is that also happening in Texas or other states too? Where do we see that?
Well, we see it. Okay. So let's kind of start with what is it? We have the private surety bail system, and then we have what we will call simple release, where you're released on your promise to come back. In California, we call it released on zero bail. And in New York, we call it released on no bond. And in Texas, we really don't see it on a statewide issue. We see it in Houston and Harris County, and there's lots of reasons for that. It's the third largest county in the country, but it's also under Democrat control, and there's been some shenanigans going on there. But they do a lot of simple release for misdemeanors there. They do a lot of simple release in California. I think they do all simple release in California for misdemeanors. And the problem is, those have high failure to appear rates. I mean, there was a judge on the News Nation town hall that was talking about the differences between the type of release mechanisms. And she said, look, I'm a former judge. And until you have something that has this same level of accountability as the private industry and the same low failure to appear rate, then you don't have an alternative. And that's the big problem.
Yeah.
In California, misdemeanors, 80% failure to appear rate. Wow. And Houston, Texas right now, according to HarrisCountyCourtWatch.com, over 2 years, the average is 83% failure to appear rate using simple release. And that's devastating to criminal cases, because when you don't show up on a criminal case, the case has to be put on hold until you come back. Mm-hmm. And so that creates huge backlogs. And I learned in California when that happens, they have a Speedy Trial Act. And so if you stay gone long enough, they have to dismiss your case. And so it just becomes a game.
Yeah.
And, because in California, they don't really go after misdemeanors after you fail to appear. That you just kind of have to come back on your own or get arrested on a new charge.
Yeah.
And so you end up playing the game. And so these simple release mechanisms create chaos, puts pressure to decriminalize by dismissing. And then when you dismiss a bunch of cases, criminals see that as a green light to commit more crime.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if there's no consequences, then what's the, you know, why change your pattern of behavior?
It gets worse because then today's misdemeanors are tomorrow's felonies, and then jail gets so full they have to start doing simple release on more and more felonies.
Mm-hmm. So what's the answer? What's the reform answer to change this, to reduce crime, to reduce recidivism? What's the process?
Well, you know, we have a case that shows us the process. It's called Sanchez versus Alabama. And, you know, they had to live under one of these court imposed injunctions for 4 years where they were required to release both misdemeanors and felons, and they couldn't hold them. They couldn't hold anybody accountable if they didn't show up for court. And after about 6 months, crime started increasing, and, you know, they had a substantial problem until 4 years later, the Court of Appeals stepped in and reversed this stupid simple release order. And so it went back down to them. They took control. And I talked to the sheriff, and he said, well, it took us a while, but we reimposed a system of accountability. We told people that if you don't show up for court, there's going to be consequences for it. And the consequences may be you're going to be held in jail till your case is resolved. And so it took them about 6 months, and crime started to fall. We know how to fight crime. We know what to do. We teach it every day at our colleges and our universities. It's called criminology. But this little social experiment we've been doing for the last few years is not based on any science. It's based on one think tank that supports another think tank doing a report saying, oh, this will not increase in crime. And then what do you know? They sold a bill of goods to one of the national parties, and they let them set their national agenda, and it didn't work, and they wouldn't say it because they had outsourced their crime agenda to these groups. And now they're going to have to decide what they're going to do about it, because our public will demand public safety. I mean, they will demand safety. That's why we have one of the reasons why we had the election result we just had. And you're starting to see that. I mean, you're going to start seeing more and more of it, and it's going to get worse. Imagine you've got our urban areas, which are predominantly under control of Democrats, if they dig their feet in and say, we're not going to change, well, then the rest of the country is going to continue to change, and you're going to have these huge disparities. And who's the people getting hurt the worst on this? It's our minority communities, because they mostly live in our urban areas. And so they think they can get away with it. I mean, here's what they were doing. We'll start this in our urban areas where we already have control. It'll be so successful, then it can grow out from there. And the reason why they were doing this is because the biggest budget items for the county is law enforcement. So we can show them how to cut their budgets for law enforcement, and we can get them to move that to other social programs, which is what we want to do. We want to spend that money on social programs. Well, it's been a complete failure. And you and me, we would say, okay, it didn't work. We got to change what we're doing. But that's not what they've done. They've doubled down on it. They've ignored it. And that's why we had the election result we did in our urban areas.
Yeah. So do you think there's a deeper cause for these things, or a more, I guess, for lack of a better way of saying, a more nefarious thought behind this, like long-term plot behind this?
Yes. Well, I do think it was nefarious because you have, you know, one person and or his family, you know, George Soros, his son Alex, that have set up all these groups. And I mean, he has the groups that provide money to people who run for DA.
Yeah.
And when they get elected, they have another set of groups that invites them to seminars and says, okay, we got you elected. Here's the quid pro quo. You're no longer going to seek enhancement on crime. So when you arrest a drug dealer with 30 pounds of meth, you're only going to charge him with possession of drugs, which is 2 weeks, instead of possession of 30 pounds of meth, which is 30 years. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to seek long sentences anymore. And it's just an on and on and on list. And then they have this other group of entities that issue pseudo reports that says, oh, doing these things, making these changes will not increase crime. And then the final groups of entities issues press releases that you will use so that you will issue a press release saying, I'm going to implement these new programs that are going to do the things they required me to do as a quid pro quo. And they're the cause of all this crime increasing. What happened to Gascon, who was one of the on the board of directors of these groups giving these seminars on what you will do and what you won't do? He got defeated by 22 points. More than half, probably maybe even two-thirds of the DAs supported by Soros in this election lost. Why? Because his policies are increasing crime, and he won't acknowledge it, and he doesn't care because he wants to move money from the counties, from law enforcement to social programs.
Interesting. Now, why? What gain is that from the county, from law enforcement to social programs?
Well, because that's where their ideology stands. That's what they want. I mean, you know, there's some politicians in New York. I did a podcast with a former assistant DA from New York, and he was providing data to the legislature about their reforms and how it would increase crime. And behind closed doors, they were telling him, look, we don't care if this increases crime as long as we get the political agenda passed. Mm-hmm. And so now we've rolled back New York's bail reforms three times, and I still think it had a big impact on crime because there's still lots of things that need to be rolled back. Like you cannot consider someone's dangerousness and whether to hold them or release them on bail. I mean, you can't look at their criminal history in New York. And so really? Those are things that, yeah, just common sense things that they're not allowing people to do. And they do it on this argument that we have a disproportionate amount of a certain ethnic groups, racial groups in our prisons. And so we have to right the ship. And it's all based on garbage. I mean, when crime goes up, it goes up faster in our minority communities. So the very groups they say they were helping got hurt the worst in all this.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like, when you talk about disproportionate groups of minorities in prison, things like that, I mean, that is a much bigger picture when you're talking about privatized prison systems, and I think the effect that's had on America, too.
But, you know, we have more data now. I mean, we've always had data that supported this, but, I mean, Minnesota, which is at the epicenter of all this, they started tracking all racial groups from the person who reported the crime all the way through the person arrested and how they're treated through the system. Mm-hmm. And so I think 2022 is the first report they released, and it showed that by a huge margin, 10-1 over other races, blacks report crimes on a 10-1 ratio. So, I mean, we have a disproportionate amount of crime being committed by one racial group, but once they get into the criminal justice system, they're treated better than other racial groups. So you can't say the system is racist when the very group that they're saying needs to be treated differently is getting a better treatment once they get into the criminal justice system. I mean, the data shows we have a disproportionate amount of crime being committed by one racial group against that same racial group. And there's a whole bunch of reasons we could talk for hours about why that is, but that is what the data shows. And so when people are saying we've got to address this systemic problem, we're actually making it worse. Because they go back and they hurt the very community they say they're trying to help.
Well, that's an interesting brings up an interesting point, because you talk about, you know, George Soros wanting to having a specific agenda. I mean, in my opinion, his agenda is more sprawling and evil than even just that. People have talked about, you know, during like the defund the police stuff, people were talking about, I think a lot of that kind of got lost in the true idea of it was not defunding the police, but so much, which some extremes did have that idea, and they were nuts. But there was initially some people who were talking, we want to redistribute funds to have some social issues to alleviate pressure from the police force doing certain things that maybe they're not equipped to do. But
some of these arguments, I mean, I did a debate with an attorney from the Civil Rights Corps, and they're the ones that are filing these lawsuits across the country where they keep losing on appeal, but then they keep doing press releases how they win. We won at the trial court. Well, yeah, but you keep getting reversed at the Court of Appeals, and you make the same arguments every damn time. But they were arguing, well, really the whole problem with crime is we just don't have enough housing. So if we would just give someone housing, they wouldn't be committing these crimes. I mean, that's like, I mean, to me, that's just a crazy argument.
Yeah,
it's like, so someone has mental issues. Someone has, they're problem children. They don't fit into society. We're going to fix all that by giving them a house. I mean, I was like, really? That's your response to murder? So if they do two murders, do they get a summer home? I mean, the real problem in our urban areas is the government has failed families.
Yeah.
I mean, they failed the drug war in our urban areas, and they've also failed economic development. You know, look at the riots that we had. I mean, people closed their business and nothing came back, so it made it even worse. So they don't have an education. They don't have anything to fall back on because their family situation's all to pot, and they have no economic opportunity. But now the government is saying, we failed you all those times, but don't worry. We're going to fix it now in the criminal justice system, in the bail reform. I mean, I think their track record is one failure after the other. I mean, when the murder rate in the United States, or the statistic is 50% of all murder victims are young black males, mm-hmm. and predominantly the murderer is a young black male as well, and we decide in bail reform that we're going to favor the young black male murderer over the young black male dead guy, we've just made day night.
Yeah.
And we've turned up to down.
Well, and that's I think I was kind of getting at it. I think part of the problem is these are all treating symptoms and not treating the sickness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, obviously we have to deal with bail reform and these issues. But we've talked about a lot of things already and the big scope of it. And I think that we've, you know, if you look at statistics in major cities over, you know, from dating back to the 60s, it's the same areas with the same crime rates and same poverty and say, like, you know, there's no improvement in these areas. So we need to find a way to,
but you know, commit. I look at it a little bit differently. I think we're committing the same errors we made in the 60s. In the 60s we felt safe, and so we became more forgiving on our criminal laws. More people were released from prison, and then crime started to increase. And so we had this debate about what to do about it. And we had one party, same party as we're having today, refused to participate in the debate, refused, denied that we were even having a problem. And so the result was we had a backlash, and that's what brought us Reagan in part with his war on drugs. I think today we're doing the exact same damn thing. We had a period where we felt safe. We were more forgiving. Now we just had the whole backlash, and now we've got Trump too.
Yeah, but I think. I mean, in part, I agree with that, but also I think we lost the war on drugs, and the war on drugs was also a farce. I mean, you're talking about. I mean, that was a complete farce. You're talking about the CIA was the one who was trafficking all the cocaine in America. So like they were the same people distributing it as well as putting people in jail for it. So you know, I mean, the war on drugs was just black book operations to make money for the CIA. So they had off book funds. I mean, that was proven with Noriega. That was proven with Freeway Rick Ross. I forget the name of the other guy who. Tom Cruise made a movie about it. But.
I don't know if I agree with very much of that. I will say, I mean, I read a book recently that said 80% of all crime can be traced back to drugs today.
Sure.
So if we give up on fighting drugs, then we're giving up on crime. And I just saw an article right before the election that I've already mentioned where, you know, California legalized marijuana and they were going to make all these taxes off of it. And the point was, of the article was that the legal drug trade or industry has collapsed and it's being taken over by the cartels. That's not the CIA. And because they've decriminalized it and because of our immigration policy, they're not just shipping in marijuana. They're moving their whole operations to federal lands and they're bringing in the workers. What are we going to do to them? We're going to arrest them for growing marijuana. We decriminalized it. And I mean, and it's dangerous. So we're spending all the tax revenue that we're raising from the legal marijuana trade to try to eradicate the illegal drug trade.
Well, as far as marijuana in California, yeah, that things like that have been happening. Although, in my opinion, I think marijuana is the least of our problems. But
if it starts with marijuana, what's next? I mean, okay, the next thing we decriminalize. Look in Oregon, they decriminalized all heavy drugs, sure. And what happened as a result?
And here's part of the problem. I don't think you should decriminalize all drugs, but also what they did is they built no infrastructure around it because they were looking at a model like Norway, who has decriminalized mm-hmm. drugs and things like that. But Norway also puts a lot of money into social services, needle exchanges, and
also have a heavy accountability element, which right. we never did.
Right. So that's what I mean.
We spent the money on the counseling. We spent the money on that. But the problem was we had no hammer to make people go. So less than 0.01% went.
Yeah. Or Oregon built no infrastructure. So it was a nightmare and they reeled it back, which they should have.
Absolutely. They let those laws expire.
But I mean, there's some drugs that I think are a problem, you know, cocaine, meth, heroin, fentanyl, things like that. When it comes to things like, you know, weed, mushrooms, things like that, I could give a shit less. Go nuts. I, you know, the overdose on that, the people committing crimes on that is non-existent.
But here's the problem when you start out with, these other drugs, maybe they're the problem. But when you start out, I mean, like in Oregon, the very next argument they started making was, well, you know, we're a free country. So if they want to overdose, they have a right to overdose. I don't believe that. I mean, I have a personal story with, you know, drug addiction. I mean, my sister had a car accident in 1989.
Yeah.
I graduated from law school in May. I didn't pass the bar exam till November. And in October, she had a car accident, broke every bone in her face. And she started a 30-year drug addiction to prescription medications. And I mean, I tried to put her in jail, which is the poor man's drug rehab. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have now killed poor man's drug rehab. I mean, we get people released before they're even down from the drunk high.
Yeah.
I mean, before they're sober, we're releasing them. And so, I mean, my sister, I mean, it wasn't until her husband died and I had her declared incompetent and I got control over and I put her in a assisted living facility where they monitor medications. And suddenly she probably had the best 4 years of her life before she passed away.
Yeah.
I mean, we've lost the hammer to make people have an incentive to go to rehab.
Sure. But now, can I ask what your sister's addiction was?
It was narcotics for pain.
Opiates, right?
Yeah.
So, yes, I mean, so then where's the accountability for pharmaceuticals, FDA, Pfizer, et cetera, who have created that, knowingly created a drug that had those addictive qualities, killed hundreds of thousands of people, and those still, there's no one going after those.
You know, I never blamed the drug companies for
you
her
addiction.
I respectfully disagree. I mean, think about it. I mean, it wouldn't take too many lawsuits to put them completely out of business.
That's
where
not
that
true.
Money, where's that true. Money going to go?
Are you familiar with Vioxx?
That money's not going to go to help people. It's going to go to line attorneys' pockets.
Are you familiar with Vioxx, Ken?
Yeah.
Vioxx, the drug Vioxx? So it was a drug that was used, I think it was something for heart murmurs or something, but it literally killed hundreds of thousands of people. And they made $12 million, made $12 million from Vioxx. And they were finally sued by people because there were so many deaths from it. There were internal memos that said they knew how many people it killed, knew it was going to kill people, but it was worth the monetary risk to do so. They had to pay $5 million in lawsuits because of this. So they made $12 million, only paid out $5 million. And the only reason they signed it, the actual agreement, was because it made them free of any other future lawsuits.
Yeah, but that one's a little bit dated now. Look at, you know, we're in the second round of weight loss drugs, and everybody's got this weight loss drug, Ozempic, whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
We've already been through one round of that, and it was causing health issues, other side effects. And there were class action lawsuits filed all over the world over that, and they paid out tons of money. I'm not even sure they didn't declare bankruptcy. I mean, or some people did. And so I think that that example that you're using is a little dated, because I think with the modern legal system, as soon as one learns about it, they all just jump on it. And it becomes, we can't keep people from using it for a purpose that it was not intended to. I mean, you can't, I mean, a doctor today can't sit by my sister and say, well, you've already taken one pill, so you can't take three more and sleep for the next 2 days. I mean, that's, I mean, there's got to be some personal responsibility at some point in time.
Sure. I mean, yeah, there has to be personal responsibility, but I mean, we do have to hold the, if we're holding people who are dealing drugs to people and making them sick and dying, doing crazy things accountable, we should be holding the people who are knowingly making drugs, pharmaceutical drugs, that are they know are making people sick and dying, and they're only doing it purely out of profit. And I think we've seen that with, again, we've seen that with Vioxx, we've seen that with opiates, we saw that with arguably the COVID vaccine, among other things. So, I mean, I think there's some correlation there, and we have to be willing to look at that too. You know, I mean, not saying that the drugs we shouldn't have. I'm not a free all drugs. Let all people do all the drugs they want. But I mean, alcohol kills far more people every year than most drugs do. You know, opiates are close behind. What is Cambridge did a study recently. And they did an algorithm of drugs, alcohol, everything, and kind of what's the worst for you, for your health, quality of life, how it affects your relationships, how it affects monetary, everything. And the number one thing above heroin and everything by a long shot was alcohol.
Well, here's the problem with alcohol. People don't have to steal to, by and large, get alcohol. They don't have to go commit crimes. They don't have to break into homes.
Well, because you sell it at a store.
By and large,
you can get it at a store.
But I do agree with you. Alcohol is one of the hardest drugs to overcome if you are an alcoholic. I've seen that. And I've seen people. I mean, I've had someone who practiced law with me just suddenly disappear to go to alcohol rehab for alcohol abuse, and and I've seen the consequences of that. But I mean, you know what we're talking about though is you know, these giving up on drug crimes. You know, if somebody is spending all day to try to find a way, and if they have people that they have kidnapped and they have them chained in a homeless encampment,
sure,
so that they can sell them to get just their next hit, there's a problem with that.
Yeah.
And that's
a
big difference than just somebody selling alcohol.
Well, but that's also a big difference than someone walking down to the corner store and buying some weed and, smoking weed for the day.
Well, but the problem we have with that is we have this, the whole movement to make weed legal is a sin tax movement. Mm-hmm. And so it's a quid pro quo. We're going to make it legal, but we're going to charge the taxes out of it like we did for cigarettes. And so
like they do
fewer people use it. And that's just not going to work. That is not going to work for weed because the black market has such a huge toe already into the industry. So, I mean, it's really a fight for, do you want to have the black market or do you want to not have it?
Well, you know, when it comes to the black market, that's just, again, going to happen. And there's no way around. I mean, you can't stop a black market on anything. There's a black market for iPhones. You know, there's a black market for Nike. So, you know, there's a black market for everything. There's always going to be someone wanting to capitalize and commit crimes. I'm not saying we don't try to curb that, but that doesn't mean we necessarily have to curb that. And also the legal version with everything, you know, those things aren't necessarily have to be one in the same, because then otherwise, if we're talking about everything that's dangerous and someone creates a black market on, well, that's everything. I mean, go back to pharmaceuticals. There's people out there. That's how a lot of people are dying from fentanyl. They're buying these pharmaceuticals from, online that are laced with fentanyl that these pressers, like, you know, you used to be able to go down to like border cities in Mexico and buy pharmaceuticals. It was the same pharmaceuticals you'd get in America, just cheaper. Now those are being pressed with stuff like fentanyl and cutting. And, people are doing that and people are dying. So does that mean we get rid of all pharmaceuticals because they're dangerous? Or do we just go after the black market, you know?
Well, we have to have, okay, so I think we're seeing what happens when we decriminalize all heavy drugs in Oregon. In fact, it got so bad that they allowed the laws to expire because they couldn't stand the impact of it.
Yeah.
And so it's a question of, what are we as a society willing to put up with? And I think by and large, I mean, when you start having cartels that, I mean, what they're doing is they're taking drugs, you know, legal drugs, and they're making them a powder, and then they're putting fentanyl in it because it's so cheap. Mm-hmm. And that makes them now have twice the amount of drugs. So that's why they're lacing it.
Right.
And so that's not okay. That can't be okay. It can never be okay.
Yeah.
And so how do we make that safe? And we have to attack the cartels. We have to attack whoever's giving them the drugs, which is coming from China, from what I read. And we have to put consequences for all that. But we don't just have an open border with no consequences. And we don't start decriminalizing our crime. I mean, drugs to make it easier to do all that. What we've seen for the last 4 or 5 years has made the problem much worse. That's the reason why you have people voting against that. The problem, you know, the debate that we're talking about is probably the larger debate that we're going to be having for the next decade or so until we resolve it. We need to review all of our criminal laws and decide what do we want as a crime going forward, what do we not. This, by requiring our DAs to have that debate, it is undermining the legitimacy of our criminal justice system, because like in Harris County, they've got programs where they're no longer prosecuting small amounts of marijuana. And then you've got Montgomery County right next door. That is. Well, I mean, the public doesn't understand why Harris County is and Montgomery County's not, I mean, or vice versa. I mean, and so they start thinking that there's some corruption in the criminal justice system and that they're using it to pick on certain minorities. And so that we can't have that we need to have as little of that as possible as a society so that we have trust in the system.
Now, do you think it should be something like a states' rights system, a states' rights issue, or a federal issue? Are we talking about?
You know, the problem we have is most crime is prosecuted by the states. So, you know, the federal, we have, so for the bail system, we have the federal system, and then we have 50 state systems.
Right.
The vast majority of crimes is prosecuted by the states. And so, but, you know, everybody wants to use the same system as the feds, which is a catch and release system, which really doesn't use the private surety system very much. But the problem is it's kind of developed into they hold 75% of the people arrested until their case is resolved. There is no state in the country that could stand to hold 75% of the people arrested. So we have to find a middle ground. And when the pendulum swings too far to the left, which is where we've been for several years, and people just get simply released and they start setting records for being arrested and committing another crime the same day, 4 or 5 times. During COVID, we got like 10 people, you know, someone arrested 10 times during a day. I mean, we were tracking it for who's gonna set the record. But we don't want the pendulum to swing too far to the right either, where we're just holding everybody before trial, because the public won't stand for when it goes too far to the left because they want safety. They won't pay for when it goes too far to the right. So we have to find a middle ground. And the middle ground is, if you want somebody to have a chance, then give them a simple release or a surety bond. If they fail to appear, then there has to be accountability and consequences for it. And if, I mean, it's kind of the difference between a charge-based release mechanism versus an individual assessment. So, you know, in New York, no matter how many times you're arrested for this small crime, you're going to get released, even if you do it 20 times in 2 weeks. But an individual assessment requires the first thing you do is look at your criminal history. If you have a long criminal history, then you're not going to get a personal bond. And if it's a violent offense, you're going to get a surety bond. And if you can't afford it, you're going to stay in jail. And that's not because you're poor. It's because you have a criminal history.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking repeat offenders, especially, it's a situation where, I mean, that's crazy. Like you said, New York doesn't even let judges look at the criminal record of someone before deciding if they should let them go out or not. That seems like the number one thing they should be looking at.
I agree with that. You know, Texas did reform 2 or 4 years ago, and you know, that was one of the three big things they changed, is you have to review criminal history. And it just seems like, well, common sense, why weren't you doing it before?
Right.
It's because they didn't have the infrastructure to show the criminal history throughout the whole state, because everything was county to county.
Yeah.
And so they set up a statewide database system, pulling it from the Texas Department of Public Safety records, and then required judges to review the criminal history that was generated by the public, by the Texas Department of Public Safety crime records. Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that makes more sense to be able to at least go in and look, because, you know, there, that's how any type of parole, sentencing, release, anything should be based. It shouldn't just be based on case to case. Like, this is the first time you've been in front of a judge in your
life.
Well,
you know, you're right, because our criminal justice system is intended to treat everybody differently, not treat everybody the same. When you're first arrested, you're going to be treated like a first-time offender, and we only
should be anyway.
The same amount of pressure, the minimum amount of pressure on you to make you to change, to become productive. But as you get arrested more, then we recognize each time the first time didn't work, so we need more pressure. I mean, these charge-based release mechanisms, systems are charge-based release requirements. They want to treat everybody the same, period, no matter how many times they've been arrested for the same crime. And that's just ludicrous. That leads to people seeing that as a green light to commit more crime.
Yeah, yeah. If there's no consequences, you know, especially as it increases, then what's the point of changing your patterns, you know?
Yeah. Well, and that's why in our urban areas especially, we have a small group of people that keep getting arrested over and over and over, because we have this little city within the big city of people that are just criminals. But what we're failing to recognize is that there's a gray area between the two, where there's these people that are watching law, you know, the criminals and the law-abiding citizens, and every day they're making a decision: am I going to be a lawbreaker or a law follower? Mm-hmm. And when they see no consequences for the group that does that all the time, they're going to go, I'm joining the lawbreaker city. But if they see consequences, if they see accountability, then they're going to say, oh, I'm sticking to the law-abiding city. And that's where we've failed miserably.
How is things like immigration been affecting this, especially in Texas being a border state and having so much, you know, the overflow of people coming into the country hitting Texas first before they had, you know, hit anywhere else? How is that being dealt with when it comes in front of the courts as far as, you know, bail and release and things like that?
Well, a constitutional amendment was just filed, probably, you know, the next legislative session in Texas in January, and they can start filing bills in November. And I think it was just last week. And so one of the first bills was filed was a proposed constitutional amendment to allow more preventative detention under the Constitution. So allow judges, based on certain crimes, to hold them and not allow them to be released. And it's arising from a situation in Houston where a girl, she was like 13, you know, snuck out of her parents' house so that she could go out for the night, and she was raped and killed by two illegal immigrants. And so you're seeing, you know, crime by illegal immigrants documented all over the country. And you're seeing, you know, some of it we've not heard of until the Trump campaign started talking about it. I mean, this whole thing about gangs from other countries that have come here illegally now taking over apartment complexes. And, you know, probably most of the your listeners have heard the exchange between J.D. Vance and someone from CNN where they were saying, well, it's just a few apartment complexes. And he's like, are you listening to yourself? Yes. One apartment complex right. in the United States allowing a gang, whether they're illegal or not illegal, to take it over would be improper.
Yeah.
And we've got elected officials looking the other way because we got an election and they don't want that to be in the news. Completely. Suddenly in the United States, crime has become so political. And we're always going to have politics and crime, but we got to take it down 10 notches. Both parties used to be law and order parties. But for some reason, with, I think, these outside influences, we've got one party that has just become, you know, the free for all for increasing crime. And I've told people for the last 3 months, we can vote. We can have all these identity politics fights next election. This election, we need to vote on crime, because when we vote on crime, then that party will moderate and suddenly become the law and order party, just like the other one. And then we can fight next time on identity politics again.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that every thing has become politicized. I don't think there's a topic that is not politicized. And not only is everything politicized, but neither side is very reasonable when it comes to making any concessions. I think everyone has just decided we are dug in on our ideas, and we don't care. Any concession is a loss, and we will not look weak, and we don't give a shit about the American people. We care about our wins and losses as a team with an R or a D in front of our
okay,
our
names. Let me make 2 points about that. On the national level, you are absolutely correct, but there's a reason for that. We have got, in a lot of subjects, we've gotten rid of the filibuster in the Senate. Mm-hmm. The filibuster in the Senate requires at least 60 or more votes before an issue can come to the floor. And so that was the mechanism that required moderation. It required simple steps. And so when something passed with bipartisan support, in the next presidential election, when there was a change of parties, we didn't spend the first 6 months or the first month undoing everything right. that the other party did.
Right.
That's never been seen before Obama. And so suddenly now with the limiting, and some people talk about getting rid of the filibuster, we're now governing from the extremes. And it's exactly right. Every time you lose an issue, it was stolen. You're no longer was it a fair fight. We were, our people didn't come out and vote. And so you see the Democrats doing that now. Whenever the Supreme Court rules on something they don't like, Supreme Court's illegitimate. And then the second point I would make on that is the experience of Texas. We live in Texas. Texas is a conservative state. It has mm-hmm. always been a conservative state. Even when it was a Democrat state, it was a conservative Democrat
right.
state.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's not a Democrat state today is because the Democrats don't have room for conservatives. They've run them off.
Right.
And so statewide races right now in Texas, the Republicans win by 13 points.
Yeah.
I mean, look at Cruz. He just won by 9. But there's a reason for that. For you to raise the money to be able to have a statewide race in Texas, you have to take positions with the money people in the Democrat Party that they will give you money. Well, the positions you have to take to get them to give you money disqualifies you from ever being able to win a statewide race in Texas.
Yeah.
And the Democrats tried a different approach with Allred. They said he was a moderate, but all they did was say he was a moderate, and then all of his voting came out and he was anything but a moderate. So you've got the money people on both sides pushing extreme issues, I mean from the extremes of both of the spectrum on both sides. And we have, I mean, I don't, until we find a way to get back to the middle and do incremental steps, we're now stuck in this repeat every time the White House changes sides, we're going to have a flurry of executive orders first right. thing to try to undo what the last party did. It's ridiculous.
Well, and I think we are unfortunately perpetually stuck in that until we have a very large overhaul, which will not be pretty, whatever it ends up looking like. Because I mean, it's just when you talk about money in politics, I mean, and this goes back to my thoughts and opinions on the pharmaceutical company as well as every other lobbyist in DC. But you know, politicians make $300,000 to $500,000 a year, but somehow we're all billionaires. It's all the lobbyists and the special interest groups and things like that. And that's where our laws seem to be coming from. They're what's good for them, not what's good for the American people. And that's big picture, but it does also reflect on what you're working on too, where, you know, they don't care about cities crumbling apart in crime because it doesn't affect them, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's just, I've said this a million times on this podcast in my life, but in my opinion, all politicians are criminals and we should probably hang all of them. And I think we'd be better. But it's all based on money and special interest groups and where they can benefit from.
Well, I do think we have a very hard dilemma right now on what to do, especially on these very important issues like criminal justice reform and bail reform. I mean, bail reform is such an easy target because nobody wants bondsmen. You can understand that really easily. But when you realize that there is no alternative, that there's only one thing the bondsmen do is get people to go to court, and they get to go to court in less, and they miss court less than 10% of the time. And the alternatives that we're trying currently either have a 50 or 80% failure to appear rate. Then you see there's no alternative.
And what is it? I got to ask, Ken, what is someone's justification? Like, steel man this for me, you know, like, what is someone's justification of, you know, obviously not yours because you're working against this, but you deal with these people. What is their justification for the process they're using now as opposed to bail? Because, like, statistically, I mean, I agree with you 100% in as far as this is concerned, like, you're talking 50 to 80% not showing up. Of course, there's no reason. There's no accountability. Whereas,
look in California, when they passed this Proposition 47 to change certain felonies down to misdemeanors, and then they quit prosecuting them.
Right.
What did they call that? They called it the Safe Streets, the Schools and Safe Streets Act, something like that. I mean, so it actually did the opposite of what they were proposing, and so it was very misleading, and there's a reason for that. I mean, in California, they had some courts put a cap on how many people could be in prison, and they were way over it.
Sure.
So they had to find ways to start releasing people, and so they started this lie to the public. Oh, we're going to do this, but don't worry, it's going to make you safer. It's not going to increase crime. And it was a lie every time, because every time they knew it was going to increase crime. And so what with rolling back Proposition 47, because Proposition 32 did that just at the election, and it passed by a huge margin. Now we go back to the problem they originally have. They need to build additional prison space. And, you know, this is a problem that's been around forever. Schwarzenegger set aside billions of dollars to do that, and he could not get it done. And so it's a stranglehold, a political stranglehold, to force criminal justice reform because they're unwilling to do what they need to do. And so that's the biggest problem we have, is politicians who are in, you know, either I agree ideologically, or they're in the pocket of someone who's pushing an agenda. And I would argue that the National Party on one side of the spectrum drank the Kool-Aid, allowed them to set their policy, and now they've lost the House, the Senate, and the presidency, in part because they were sold a bill of goods and it was all wrong.
Yeah, so you're, I guess to answer the question, you would say these people, in their head, do you think they're doing the right thing, or do you think they're just it was just kind of a mandate top down? Hey,
well, I think, you know, it's a coalition that passed. You know, when a president is elected, it's a coalition. I think there's part of the coalition that are the true believers. We're just helping people, the downtrodden. But you've got a part of that coalition that are troublemakers, and you've got a part of that coalition that has an agenda to move funds from the police law enforcement budget to social programs. And the easiest way they can do that is by saying, we don't need all these officers, we can defund the police and we'll have all this extra money, we can move to law enforcement, and we can release more people from jail and save all this money and move it to social programs, and we won't increase crime. And so when you hear that, you're just being lied to.
Now, how, in your opinion then, in expertise, how do you fix this problem, or what do you, how do you approach it? Because there's so many prongs to this, but I do agree, we do need more social programs. We do need more things to, again, fix the, not the symptoms, but where this starts. And where this starts is all family and education. You know, as someone who grew up in South Central LA in the 80s, at the height of gang violence, at the height of the crack epidemic, at the height of violence with the LAPD in the Rampart District, and every, you know, Rampart the problems they were having. You know, I saw it all growing up. I saw it all. And there's a lot of problems involved with
it. Well, but, you know, I would start by saying, you know, the government has already failed on all of these things that you're talking about. They've already failed on these social programs. They've already failed on fixing families. They've already failed on, you know, drugs in our urban areas. They failed on economic development. So that's not really the goal of the criminal justice system. I mean, if we need all that addressed, but we need it addressed before you get to the criminal justice system. When you get to the criminal justice system, it is intended to give closure to victims, to give justice to victims, and to to impose the amount of pressure that needed on the defendant to either put him away or cause him to change his direction so that he or she will be a productive citizen. And so we're now trying to make the criminal justice system do things it was never intended and can't do. And let me give you one example. I think this is the best example on that. Mental illness. All of the training for mental illness is, we're going to support you. When you tell me something, I take it at face value. I'm your counselor. So I don't dispute it. I don't question it. I am there to support you. When we put mental health when we make the Harris County Jail the largest mental health facility in the state, it does not mix with criminal justice. And right now with all this bail reform, when you say I've got a mental health issue, that becomes a King's X on the criminal case. Well, we're going to dismiss the case because poor you, you've got a mental health problem. Well, what do you think our career criminals figure out of that? Oh, I've got a mental issue.
Yeah.
And we can't question it because we're going to send a mental health worker in there to talk to them. And they've been taught, we're supporting you. We take what you say at face value. And so we've got people who are cooking the system and they're using it to get out of criminal cases. And we can't have that.
Well, here's the thing. I agree and disagree with both those things. because we do need mental health in prisons, because otherwise what's the point of prison besides it's reform? We want people to be reformed. Do we want to just lock these people away for X amount of time and nothing has changed, or do we want them to be reformed? I don't think that the mental health should subvert and replace your penal sentence, but it should be combined with that. So when you are released, we truly have done our best to rehabilitate you. Because if you just lock someone in a box and then let them back out, you're not actually fixing a problem. They're just older, you know?
Mental health is a huge spectrum of issues.
Sure.
And so we've got, the problem we have is we have a large group of them that they get out of jail, they get off their meds, and they can no longer be controlled.
Mm-hmm.
An incident happens, they get arrested, they go back to jail, and suddenly they get back on their meds again because they couldn't afford them, whatever reason. They don't have family. Nobody was making them take them.
Right.
And so it becomes just a vicious cycle. But also, you know, sometimes people with mental health issues are high functioning, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got schizophrenia where, you know, I described my sister at one point because she had a brain injury, but she was very smart. And I said, she has lost her moral compass. So she will do anything that she thinks she needs to do, because she has no governor, you know, like on the old cars that wouldn't allow you to go over a certain speed. She had no moral governor on her that would stop her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of when people who have certain types of mental illness, some of our serial killers that we expressed or we've seen in history, they know the difference between right and wrong. They just don't care.
Right.
And so we can't allow mental health issues to suddenly become something that overcomes. I mean, when you're saying, oh, I'm no longer going to seek a long sentence because I had this group support me to get elected, that's an easy out. Well, they got a mental illness. I'm just going to dismiss them. Well, that's going to hurt the public.
Right.
And we just need individual assessments, which is the worst thing the government is able to do at times.
Well, and that's kind of what I mean. I don't think that a mental health diagnosis should replace the sentencing for the crime. But but we should be helping these people to rehabilitate them. So when we do let them back out, it's not just see you in a few months, or like, you know, or in, but even if they're on meds, like you said, and then they stop taking their meds and they commit a crime again. We can't predict that. It's not a crime to not stop taking your meds, right? You may commit a crime when you stop taking your meds.
Yeah, okay, but that's the reentry issue.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, and you know, look at my sister as an example. I mean, she didn't ever end up going to jail, but we'll use her as an example. I mean, how do you, her family was her best opportunity at being successful. If she had gone to jail, she would have been dead because she was abusing prescription drugs. She would have gotten out. She would have overdosed. She would have been dead. And so even, but she had a long period where her, you know, our family had really cut her off because we couldn't deal with the drama.
Sure.
And so, but even after all those years, you know, one of us came back. And so I, even today in all these bad situations, I mean, there are some things the government just is not good at doing. And even in the, in those situations, I think is the best example. Your family, if we have a family, is your best opportunity to be able to have long-term success.
Okay, I love this because you're kind of making my point I made earlier.
I'm doing it. Yeah, I didn't even realize it.
Because I, you know, I said we're fighting symptoms as opposed to fighting the problem. We need to focus on family and education. And you kind of rebutted that, you know, it's not the court's job to focus on family and education, and the penal and the, in the, you know, the justice systems. And I agree with that. It's not their it's not their job to focus on family education. I do think they should focus on rehabilitation, which there's a large lack of in the justice system. But you just said, you know, your sister's biggest opportunity was her family. Well, the government does have an opportunity, whether it's local is probably better than federal, to start focusing on family and education in areas, especially poor, in urban areas that have the largest problems. And if we started putting more, we can't just be like, well, they have problems, so when they go to jail, we got to deal with it. Well, yeah, but that's just going to continue the process because we're not plugging the leak. We're just letting it leak and fixing it when the water starts making our socks
wet. Here's the problem we've got. The mental health people, they're not constituents of our of anyone running for office. I mean, look at where we've seen money. I mean, look in California where they have passed bond elections with billions of dollars with the concept of we're going to build homes for homeless people. And, you know, it's now under court supervision because they've built so few homes and spent so much money because of the corruption. Look at we're going to build electric recharging facilities, and they set aside how many billions of dollars, and they spent, I mean, they've only built a limited number and they don't work. I mean, these are all problems, and, you know, the politicians don't really have a constituency of mental health people that are going to support and not support them. And so that's part of the problem. And then the other issue is, okay, we get them through the criminal justice system and they're wherever they are. That's when we should be looking at treating their mental health issues, not right when they're arrested. We need to have better triage and decide, but there are people that just need to go through the system, and that's a reentry issue, not a whether we're going to proceed with criminal charges.
Sure, but I'm talking about, and I agree with that, but I'm talking about family and education at a core level when they're young, before they're criminals, before they're committing crimes. And, like, you know, I mean, basically,
but that's a generation thing. We're so lost on families in our urban areas already. Well, so that would take a generation to change.
Right. Well, so and what are we going to do? Do we just not start? You know,
well, that doesn't mean we don't start.
I'm not disagreeing with your ideals on how we necessarily and how we tackle when they come to the court. Okay. That is something we still do need to absolutely take care of as it comes to you. But we also need to find a way to slow that trickle, slow that. It's not
absolutely
even a trickle. So that's what I talk about, family and education. And kind of, I mean, you just said that, like, I don't know, they don't have constituents to deal with the mental health stuff, and we can't trust the government to handle that. They are not competent enough to handle the family education and taking care of those things. I mean, but if they're not competent enough to handle something like that, they're not competent enough to handle the justice system.
Those are two different groups of the government, and the justice system has been operating, you know, the way it is. But
I mean, I think the government, they are different arms, but if the government can't do one thing, they can't do another.
But let me make this point. So, you know, there's these statistics that say if you drop out of school, you have a much more greater chance of going to prison.
Sure.
And so in our urban areas, we have had schools and that have decided that the way they're going to handle that is they're going to pass everybody.
Right.
They're not going to teach anymore. They're just going to be babysitting. And yeah. So you have classes that are 1-2 years behind on reading.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing it. You could say that's in a good name because they're saying if they drop out, then they have a greater chance of going to prison. But they're dumbing down the whole class.
Right.
And so we don't have anybody that's going to excel. And so everybody's going to have a problem when they get out. And so, in the long term, the problem is going to be much, much worse. And we can't bring that kind of thinking to the criminal justice system, which when you think about it, these case-based or charge-based release systems for simple release, that's what they're doing. They're just bringing that type of mentality to the criminal justice system. We can't have that.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. I think we need to take care of I'm not fighting you on criminal justice as it comes and as we have to deal with it. I would probably mostly agree with your opinions and on that stuff. I just think the government has done little to nothing to stop those problems from continually occurring. We're just band-aiding stuff, we're just band-aiding things instead of actually focusing on the
problems. Well, I think the biggest problem for that is especially in our inner cities is we've got one party rule. I mean, we need to get a competitive race where everybody's talking about how we can improve the schools, how we can improve families.
Yeah.
And then you vote on the person promising the best, because right now you've only got one party there. Nobody's talking about it because in the general election, no matter whoever wins the primary is going to get elected. So you've got candidates that'll have a barbecue once a year or once every 4 years for everybody in the community. And oh, how great they are. We had that in Houston. It was, one of the congressmen. She just passed away. She's had a barbecue once every 4 years. Yeah. Oh, everybody loved her and nothing ever changed.
Well, yeah, I always talk about like where I'm from in LA, Maxine Waters is the representative from that area. And she's been the representative for like 30 years, forever. I mean, since I was a little kid and I'm 40, 42 or whatever. And her district.
Young. You're very young. Yeah,
her district has just gotten perpetually worse. And perpetually worse and perpetually worse. But because, she grew up in the neighborhood and she's a black lady. She just keeps getting reelected. But she lives nowhere near the district. The area is like Watts and Compton and Paramount, this terrible area.
So yeah, but I think this election was the first time that changed. And it didn't change a lot because the Democrats still won the urban areas, but by the smallest margin probably in a generation.
Yeah,
and so they're looking at that and going, oh my God, oh shit.
Yeah.
And if that continues, then we'll never get reelected again for presidency for statewide office. So you're going to start seeing that change.
Yeah.
It just needs to change more. And a lot of that's going to depend on Trump. And if Trump does, what he says he's going to do, that'll bring a spotlight there. If he gets caught up in trying to correct past injustices, which I think he's justified on, then the public will see that Republicans will get decimated in two years in the midterms. And then, Trump may be the first president to be impeached for three times, because if the Republicans get back control of the House, they'll impeach him a third time. Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah. Well, I will agree with you. I think he does have a phenomenal opportunity to really make a difference in the second presidency. He, his first presidency, I think it was a lot of ego. And I think he just didn't know how to govern. And he made bad appointees. He made bad decisions. He let other people around him make those decisions.
I think part of it is he wasn't a politician. He's a New York person. So if you hit him, he's going to hit back.
Right.
That's just his mentality. Yeah. In fact, they learned, let's bait him and watch him hit back. Oh, yeah. And then we'll make that the story.
Yeah.
And that's, that's because he's not a politician. But he is a very fast learner. You can already see somewhere around the middle of this election cycle, he quit responding.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly he became jovial. He became happy. And this wasn't the old Trump. And so I think that he has learned. And so I think that his appointments are there. And I think some of them may not be there just to get approve, they may be there to address other issues. I think Trump is that smart.
Yeah.
And so if you think about it, the attorney general appointment could be to get rid of a problem from the House that was a problem to the speaker. The speaker now owes Trump a big favor. And if he gets confirmed by the Senate, he does. If he doesn't, well, then you got a recess appointment. If you don't have that, maybe the governor of California, of Florida, will appoint him to Rubio's seat. So, I mean, you've got all kinds of different possibilities that I think other politicians wouldn't be able to think that far ahead. And I think Trump is thinking of all of those and even more.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see what shakes out over the next 4 years. I'm just excited about a couple of the people that are around him. that's my hope. You know, yeah, you put people like Tulsi Gabbard, Vivek, and RFK around you, I think you've got some interesting ideas to potentially make.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if they're confirmed. They're already being attacked so strongly. I mean, Gabbard's been accused of being a Russian shill, and then Kennedy.
They tried that with Trump too, though. You know,
I mean, yeah, they said it with Trump, but I mean, you know, the medical industry complex is going to come out against him as hard as they can, yeah. And the military Gabby's enemies are going to come out in force. So, but on the criminal justice side, I am very hopeful. Because what we're doing now is not sustainable. I think mm-hmm. the vote for president and for senators and congressmen, House members across the country, I think showed that along with the border policy. And so I think it will have to change. And I think we're starting to see change. So I'm very hopeful for that.
Well, I definitely, as far as the reform and the bail and things like that, I definitely agree with you. I think that's a crazy policy. I watched it happen in California and LA, where I'm from, and it just made no sense to me. I mean, I don't even, well, I think it was almost 2 years ago last time I was back in LA, and I went through downtown where I, you know, and I'm just walking, it's a nightmare. It's just a night. It's like a walking nightmare. And I'm like, and I used to go back and visit family every year. And now it's been, I'm like, I don't even go back.
Well, you know, when the NAACP in Oakland issues a press release demanding a state of emergency on crime and electing and attacking their local elected officials that they all supported, you know, there's a problem. And so, you know, I was saying when that happened, our national politicians cannot say we don't have a crime problem in light of that. They still said it. And that's why they had the result they had.
Well, yeah. I think I said this earlier in the podcast, but that's 100% why we got the results we got, is because people just, you know, the American people came out in droves as a whole and said, your policies are not working for this country. There's crime, there's an immigration problem, there's an economic problem.
Well, what would the election results, how bigger would it have been if they didn't have the abortion issue?
Right.
I mean, the abortion issue kept it from being even bigger. It didn't stop it like it did 2 years ago. So if you imagine if you didn't have all the lawfare and you didn't have the abortion issue, I mean, we're talking Trump's in Reagan area. I think you
crazy.
Almost have to put him in Reagan area because he still won.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was already a massacre.
I mean, he's
out there.
He is only the second president in the history of the United States to be elected in non-consecutive terms.
Yeah.
Grover Cleveland was the first. Donald Trump is the second.
Yeah.
I mean, it's that impossible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he won every single swing state. Every single one.
In Texas, he won every border county but one.
Which one didn't he win?
You know what? I don't know.
Okay. I'd just be curious.
I just saw a chart on it. Every one but one was red.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. I've got a lot of I got a lot of friends who live in El Paso. I go down there quite a bit for comedy and stuff. And you know, I mean, I'm Hispanic. They're all Hispanic. Even those people are just like, listen, this is it's crazy. This is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, all the border guards or all the people who work border control, most of them are Hispanic. You know,
sure.
But they understand a problem when they see it. You know,
yeah.
And it's just been crazy. So. Yeah, Anyway, Ken, we've been at this an hour and a half. I don't want to keep you all day here.
But well, I was going to say, is your name Joe Rogan?
Right? Yeah, believe me, I've done 3-4 hour podcasts with people, so it can go long. I just don't. I mean, I could go all day, but I don't want to keep you. I'm sure you got stuff to do. So, I appreciate you coming on. This has been an interesting talk. You know, maybe we can revisit and later this year, or next year, and see how things are going. And what direction we're headed, if it's the sure. right way or not. So is there anything any last words, anything you want to say, anything where people can support the what you're doing, or I don't sure. know how they I don't know if there's anything coming up or what.
Well, I would say if people want more information about me or my organization, you could go to pbtx.com, the Professional Bondsman of Texas. So pbtx.com. We have a blog where we highlight important law enforcement stories, but we also have our own podcast, and there's a link to both of those on our menu. But you can also go directly to our podcast at thebailpost.com. Bail is in B-A-I-L, but thebailpost.com. And we have, that's all we talk about, criminal justice issues. You want to know what the New Jersey plan is? We've got an episode on it. You want to know what charitable bail funds are and why they're being limited by certain states? We've got multiple episodes on it. So
okay, sounds good. I'm going to check it out. Well, Ken, I appreciate you coming on. Next time I'm in Tyler, performing, I'll get you some tickets to come see the show.
All right, great.
So guys, as for me, go to deescomedy.com, check out everything going on across the network. Again, I've got a couple live dates still through the end of the year. They're a little limited. You guys that follow me know I've been working on the comic book series Kill Stan that's out right now, so get those. First issues are out, second issue's coming soon. That's kind of the focus till the end of the year, and the second issue should be coming out around January, so keep an eye out for that. And that's it, guys. So as for the Social Hour, I've been Deese, and for Ken, thank you all very much, and we will see you all next week.